I thought you just got off of the plane. Desert sand still in your shoes. When the sand was probably Virginia Beach. And you were from Newport News. I thought you were an Arab. I saw the desert in your eyes. I thought of asking for a job in Abu Dhabi till you sprang the big surprise. You handed me the money. That's what a real Arab does. So I thought you were an Arab, and all the time you were the fuzz. I thought you were an Arab, a desert caliph or a sheikh. I thought I'd be your friend in Congress, you'd be grateful, what a terrible mistake. You handed me the money, and that was all I saw. So I thought you were an Arab, and all the time you were the law. Abdul was kind of obvious, now that I've time to think it through. The way you spoke American without an accent sure reflected well on you. When you handed me the briefcase filled with cash, I accepted with a wink. You can catch it on the evening news, you rat. Now I'm headed for the clink. I thought you were an Arab when you were really apple pie. You had a little shopping list of congressmen, and prominent upon the list was I. I smiled for the camera, I couldn't see it from my seat. So I thought you were an Arab, and all the time you were the heat. You were Lawrence of the FBI, you really played it to the hilt. There'll be no mercy back in Jersey when you tell them how the fatal milk was spilt. I thought you were kings of the fabled East, all you really were was bums. I got caught with my hand in the cookie jar, and my hands were filled with crumbs. I thought you were an Arab, I saw the desert in your eyes. I thought of asking for a job in Abu Dhabi till you sprang the big surprise. You handed me the money, that's what a real Arab does. So I thought you were an Arab, and all the time you were the fuzz. I thought you were an Arab, and all the time you were the fuzz.
Well, that was Tom Paxton. Both, of course, his own compositions from his most recent album, which is called The Paxton Report. Tom Paxton is with me now. He became very popular first in the 1960s when the Greenwich Village folk music scene was thriving. His best-known songs, recordings which were staples of many record collections and standards at the folk clubs and concerts, include Can't Help But Wonder Where I'm Bound and The Last Thing on My Mind. Tom Paxton left America for a few years to live in England. He has recorded about 15 albums on the Verve record label and currently records for a small folk label called Mountain Railroad Records. His new albums, as we've heard, feature his new topical songs with commentary on issues like nuclear power, the ERA, abscam, and presidential media politics. Tom Paxton is in Philadelphia to perform tonight at the Bijou with 2 Cents at 8:30 and at 11. And opening for the concert this evening will be Mimi Farina. Tom Paxton has brought his guitar with him and will be performing for us live in the studio. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Do you think that...
It's only a historical note, by the way, but I didn't record for Verve ever. I don't know who got that.
Vanguard is what I meant.
Vanguard.
That's just a slip
and Elektra.
Yeah, it was Vanguard. That was just a slip of the mind and the pen. Political things are kind of changing now. There's very conservative people in power, and liberal and radical people are beginning to organize. And I wonder if you think that's going to affect the interest in and the need for topical songs.
Well, there's always a need for topical songs. I mean, there never has been a time when there hasn't been something going on that would make a song. The question is whether how deeply felt that need is, and I think the jury is very much out. It looks as if things are getting active again. If they do, it'll be to my surprise, because I have a privately held theory that with a conservative at the top, things tend to get conservative all the way down. That it was really an activist president like John Kennedy who kicked things off. But, you know, that's just my theory, and who am I? At the same time, it looks like, you know, people are getting very very active on questions of nuclear energy and El Salvador and with the budget going through the way it is, who knows what's going to happen. I'm sure that you guys at the station here are about ready to march, aren't you?
Well, I've noticed that for people who disagree with Reagan politics, that there's basically two ways that people feel, and it's divided, that some people are very excited and think that this will help mobilize people who've been listless or apathetic, and that mm-hmm. there'll be a movement again. And other people are just plain worried. How do you feel about it?
Well, I'm with the other people. You know, if you read a little bit of history, you'll realize that the first of those alternative friends of mine you mentioned is lunacy. I want to emphasize for a second that I am not myself a communist, but the communists in Germany back in the 20s and 30s, early 30s, many of them said, right, let's let the Nazis take over. And things will be, you know, so bad that then the door will open for us. And I just don't want to encourage, you know, ultra-conservatism for some hoped-for goal a little bit. I'd rather pursue things, you know, one day at a time, a little more sensibly and a little more progressively. But I don't want any more conservatism than I have to put up with.
One of your songs on your most recent album, The Paxton Report, is about how all the presidential candidates during elections have media advisors and get on TV and all say the same thing, which is what they think the American public wants to hear.
Oh, yeah.
Do you vote?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I usually vote Democratic. You know, sometimes I hold my nose to do it. I've never voted Republican, but I vote... I never miss a vote locally in Eastern Long Island where I live. Sometimes, I mean, you feel like kind of something of a chump, I think, doing it. But I always do.
Yeah, I know a lot of people feel that the really key elections are the local ones where each vote counts a little more and where the person has maybe a more direct influence.
You guys are probably getting some New Jersey gubernatorial commercials on your stations here as they are in New York City because of the spillover into New Jersey. And it's really just astonishing. All these guys, they are all saying the same thing. I mean, it's like the same... I think there's one media guy who sewed them all up and wrote all of their TV commercials. They all sound exactly the same.
What politicized you? Was there a turning point for you?
It was a gradual point. I think the thing that politicized me, now that you ask me that and I'm forced to think about it, I think that the Civil Rights Movement did. Before the Civil Rights Movement, I was a college boy in Oklahoma, and I was certainly getting more and more interested in folk music, and I was learning songs sung by Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie's songs, and I understood intellectually, you know, singing a union song and that sort of thing, what I was singing. But I didn't feel them the way I subsequently came to feel them, you know, when I'd had a little more life out in the cold, hard, cruel, hard world. When I came up to New York in 1960, the Civil Rights Movement was really getting hot. And I found myself right in the middle of it. And that's what politicized me, I'm sure of it.
What do you mean in the middle of it?
Well, I was doing rallies and march, peace marches and civil rights marches and fundraisers and, you know, what have you.
Yeah. Can you do one of your new songs for us?
Oh, I'd love to. Let me think quickly which one I'd like to do. Here's just a piece of nonsense that I wrote. I'll sing it a little while longer and then probably put it on the reject here. Rosalind's in the White House, drinking from a silver cup. Nancy's on the sidewalk crying, can't you hurry up? It's nice to win, now I wanna move in. Way back in November, we took most every state. Now I'm simply itching to get in and decorate. I've got my plan, called a moving van. Oh, Rosalind's so selfish, spoiling Nancy's fun. Sitting in the White House till Timmy's term is done. Please be a sport and cut it short. You'd think she'd get the message, you'd think it enough to state. Nancy wants the White House and she doesn't want to wait. Tough Georgia luck, back up the truck.
And while we're on the subject, here's another pet peeve of mine. Why wait for the coronation? Tell your husband to resign. By the way, God bless my new red dress. Oh, Rosalind's in a White House drinking from a silver cup. Nancy's on the sidewalk crying, can't you hurry up? It's nice to win. Now I want to move in.
Really heavy-duty stuff there.
That's funny. You know, when you're doing topical songs, if it's about a subject that just happened, you're going to have to eventually put it on the shelf, like what you just said. You said, I'll do this for a while, and then I'll put it on the shelf.
Yeah, but you know, not necessarily. It's kind of fascinating. You never know exactly what song is going to take a hold, but sometimes a song will just click in people's minds, and they want to hear it again. For example, a song I wrote in 1969 called Forest Lawn, about Forest Lawn Cemetery. I still get requests to do that. I still get tons of requests to do Talkin' Vietnam Potluck Blues. So you never know. I mean, this song might, you know, capture someone's imagination, and they'll ask to hear it, you know, 5 years from now. Sing us that one about Nancy Reagan in the White House.
And it's funny, because in 20 years it'll become a historical document, right?
Sure.
No, I mean, really, once things change from yesterday to history,
sure,
they're viewed differently, and it becomes a really important piece of detail that documents a period. I think of all the folk songs, like from England, that are about kings and queens.
That's,
you know,
right. Well, what do you think all the civil rights, the songs from the jails will, they already are historical documents, you know. I mean, I was driving my car a couple weeks ago, and I was listening to, I was in Chicago, and they were playing a Pete Seeger concert, and he was singing some of the old civil rights songs, and God, I felt like a wave of nostalgia came over me and everything, and, you know, just like some old grizzled veteran or something, and singing songs that were written in prison cells in Birmingham. And of course, they are historical documents.
You've played in a lot of different kinds of settings, from, you know, folk clubs to folk festivals and rallies. And,
oh, sure.
I wouldn't be surprised if you were playing when riots were about to happen either.
I once played on second base in Shea Stadium, but that was a big peace rally there.
Do you have any favorite kinds of settings? Is there a difference between what you'll be doing for a song at a big rally or at a small concert?
No, there isn't any difference. Really, now that we have most of the times there's wonderful sound systems at our disposal, really, you don't change the performance. I mean, you don't have... You're tempted to try to sing louder just from the psychology of it, when you actually don't have to. Mm-hmm. But no, I can't change anything. I can't play the guitar any better or any louder. Some of these settings can be so different that it's hard to say. I guess the short answer would be that I like any setting where it goes well. You know, if I feel like the songs have got through, then I'm happy with it, and it was good. And if I don't feel that, I feel it went terribly. Sometimes I love to play in a tiny little room. You know, I've played folk clubs in England that were no bigger than this room we're sitting in now, which is very small. And there's a place up in New England where I will be playing sometime this year that only seats 80 people. And I look forward to that. And at the same time, I played at Peace Marches in Washington with hundreds of thousands of people. And I played at a rock and roll festival in England where there were a quarter of a million people. And all of these were very satisfying in their way, each in their own way.
Most people who know your music start their knowledge of you with the time that you arrived in New York. But what were you doing before that? What kind of background are you from? Where did you grow up?
I have a resolutely middle-class background. I was born in Chicago, raised in Oklahoma. Went to University of Oklahoma. Took a degree in drama there, 59. I thought that all during my college years, my mind was inclined toward being an actor. And I studied drama, worked at it very hard. But all that time, my interest in folk music was growing steadily. And I had a couple other pals in college, and we played the guitar together a little bit. And I think my last year there, we had our own little Kingston Trio, because Kingston Trio had just made it big. Before that, we were already interested in Weavers and, Pete Seeger. So by the time I got out of school, I was really, really wanted to try this, really wanted to do this. Hardly dared hope that I could. I mean, it just seemed like an impossible dream. But I wanted to so badly that I thought I'd, go ahead and try. I'm glad I didn't know then what I know now. I probably would have, I wouldn't have had the nerve to try it, but I did. And while I was in the Army, they sent me up to the New York area, and I would come into Greenwich Village on weekends. And a friend of mine from college had a little apartment there, and I slept on the sofa on weekends and hung around the coffee houses and gradually got a chance to get up and sing for nothing or for a hamburger or a free coffee or now and then substitute for somebody. And when I got out of the Army in fall of 60, I just stayed.
Must have been a really schizophrenic experience to be in the Army during the week and in the Village on weekends.
It was, especially since later in the summer of 60, I was stationed at Fort Dix, and we had a real macho first sergeant, and he had us practically shave our heads, And mind you, hairstyles weren't as long in 1960 as they subsequently became, but mine was a little excessively short. But, people just made the best of that.
Did you have to justify the other existence
place? No, the Army was just, was part of our lives. And then, the draft, peacetime draft, had been going on for 10 years.
I think of all the young people who wanted to go to Greenwich Village and try singing, and all the parents who convinced them that they were fools and that they should go to college and become a professional something or another. Mm-hmm. Was there pressure on you to straighten up? Yeah. And
Most of the time, by the way, I think that's the right advice. I think actually people should be discouraged from trying to do this sort of thing professionally. And the ones who say, I'm sure that's good advice, but nevertheless I'm going to do it, are the ones who go ahead and do it, and they'll be all right in the end anyhow. But it can get very hairy. I forgot the rest of your question, Terry.
Oh, well, there was pressure on you, like from
your
parents or older people.
Well, my father died when I was 10. If he had lived, I'm sure the pressure would have been intolerable, because my father was an extremely conservative guy. I don't know, it would have been a merry scene, I'll tell you that. Who knows how I would have turned out, if I'd had another 10 years of that kind of influence. I might sadly have decided on doing something else, safer. My mother worried a lot, as mothers tend to do, and inquired hesitatingly one day whether I might not like to take the civil service test and see about getting a post office job or something. There was no real pressure. Yeah. It was just, I'm sure she would have been happy if I'd tried something a little safer.
Were you discovered? Or did things happen gradually?
I'm still waiting for that to happen. No, no big breakthrough event. I think one of the most fortunate things that happened to me was along about 1962. I'd already been in New York a couple years, and I was working mostly in Greenwich Village, but I was traveling a bit around the East Coast. I was coming down here. I think I had maybe played once or twice at the Second Fret. But actually, that might still have been in the future for me. But anyhow, I met Pete Seeger after we had a big committee against the blacklist. Pete was still being blacklisted in those days, and there was this hideous show on television called Hootenanny that was just the most abysmal homogenization of folk music that you ever saw in your life, but there it was, and Pete should have been on it and would have done it no end of good. It was the talent coordinator was a guy named Fred Weintraub, who owned the Bitter End Coffee House in New York and now makes movies. And they tried, I mean, they made every kind of waffly claim that they didn't have Pete on because he didn't have an audience. I mean, it was just patent nonsense. What it was a blacklist. And so a lot of us formed a committee against the blacklist and boycotted the show. Now, it was one thing for people like me to boycott the show who hadn't been asked to be on it. It was no big, courageous stand on my part, for God's sake. But it spread quite quickly, and people like John Baez and Peter Paul and Mary and the Kingston Trio all said, as a matter of fact, they went one step further. They said, not only we won't be on the show with Pete, but if you'll have Pete, we will be on the show. And by this time, they were much bigger than the Hootenanny show, and it would have, and it really exposed the ABC network for the frauds they were at that time, because they didn't even have, they could have had Peter, Paul, and Mary if they'd had Pete, and they still wouldn't have Pete. So it was obvious that it was a political blacklist.
I think I remember when that was broken, when he sang the Big Muddy on the Ed Sullivan show?
Yeah, something like that. I think so, yeah. Anyhow, we after one of these big committee meetings that went on and on and on, I met Pete. Eyes on the floor, kicking the sand, very abashed, because, I mean, he really was a hero to me. And I asked him if I could sing a song for him that I had written, and he said, of course. And I sang him Ramblin' Boy. And he was very enthusiastic about it, asked me if he could sing it, and sang it around the world. And really, always mentioned my name before he sang it. And it just did me no end of good. Really helped. Really helped people to become aware that there was such a galoot. And I'm still grateful to him for that. Recently, on March 28th, Pete and I did a joint concert, a benefit concert for Clearwater up in a high school in Yonkers. It was the first time I'd ever done a duo concert with Pete. It was the same kind of format of the concerts he does with Arlo, which is we both took the stage, shared the stage, took turns, sang some songs together, and it was, boy, was it wonderful for me. And I gave him another song, which I sang that night. He wanted, so he's now singing another new song. Would you like to hear that one?
Yeah, I would.
This is a song based on what's happening down in Central America now. I'd love to sing this song at Secretary of State Haig one of these days. The army comes through. They curse us and prod us with guns. Sometimes they take us away, and that's the end of that. They go where they like in our houses. Their eyes miss nothing of value. And may the Virgin be with you if you've a gun or a knife. But who speaks for me? I who have no voice. Who decides for me? For it seems I have no choice. Do I live, do I die? Will my family survive? Will this side, will that side allow us a life? One question I'd ask if I dared, of the ones whom we never see. Guns and dollars are voices for you, but who speaks for me? We are never asked. We are simply shown to the fields. We give of our youth and our blood to the cotton and coffee. While the gods in the long white houses raise the dust in their long black cars,
They regard us with faces of stone, and they grind us like corn. But who speaks for me? I who have no voice. Who decides for me? For it seems I have no choice. Do I live? Do I die? Will my family survive? Will this side, will that side allow us our lives? One question I'd ask if I dared, of the ones whom we never see. Guns and dollars are voices for you, but who speaks for me? We are born like calves. We are held to be valuable things. The gods in the long white houses send to hear us sing. In the heavy air of the evening, while the blossoms float on the pools, we pluck our guitars for survival, and we smile like fools. But who speaks for me? I who have no voice. Who decides for me? For it seems I have no choice. Do I live? Do I die? Will my family survive? Will this side, will that side allow us our lives? One question I'd ask if I dared, of the ones whom we never see. Guns and dollars are voices. But who speaks for me? One question I'd ask if I dared, of the ones whom we never see. Guns and dollars are voices for you, but who speaks for me?
It's a really good song.
Thank you.
You said you'd like to sing that for Alexander Haig.
I'd love to, yeah. I don't expect I'll get the chance anytime soon. But
you've had an experience as a performer and as a listener with political songs. Do you think that they change people's opinions and reach people and give messages that...
No, I don't think they really change opinions so much. They express them, that's all, you know. I think that they... Of course, I'm very close to the subject since I write these things and sing them. But let me put my other hat on for a second as a listener. Driving down that Chicago street only last week, listening to WFMT, and there was Pete singing We Shall Overcome, they say. And it made me feel part of Pete. Part of a force that I feel is a good force, a positive force. And, you know, if I'm really lucky, somebody somewhere will feel that way hearing one of my songs. They'll say, well, I agree with that. I feel that way. I'm glad that guy wrote that song.
I really know what you mean, that kind of feeling of feeling this unity with people through sharing music together.
Sure.
I also think that music helps clarify people's thoughts too, particularly young people, because I know when I was a teenager and everybody was listening to your songs and a lot of other...
Well, you know what really songs, did that is the times they are changing. Say Dylan's song, The Times They Are Changing, did that. That song had tremendous crystallizing effect, I think, on kids back in the early 60s.
Can I make a request?
Sure.
Would you like to sing The Last Thing on My Mind, which is a
I'd
song
be
I'm
happy
sure
to.
A lot
this
of
one goes awfully far back. I still like to do it, so it's no chore at all.
Yeah.
It's a lesson too late for the learning. Made of sand, made of sand. In the wink of an eye, my soul is turning. In your hand, in your hand. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better. I didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. You've got reasons aplenty for going. This I know, this I know. For the weeds have been steadily growing. Please don't go, please don't go. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better. I didn't mean to be unkind. Oh, that was the last thing on my mind. As I lie my bed in the morning, without you, without you. Each song in my breast dies born in, without you, without you. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved it better. Didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. That was the last thing on my mind.
Pretty song. It wears well.
Thank you.
It's a good tune. You know, at about the time that you wrote that song, and a lot of people, a lot of young people around the country were trying to figure out what kind of future they wanted, you know, and that song and a lot of other songs are, like, to me, associated with a period of trying to figure out, well, you know, what kind of an adult should I be and what kind of life should I go after, and all the big questions that you always ask yourself when you're a teenager, and there are questions I know you had to ask yourself, having traveled between, like, the Midwest and the Army and the village, and, you know, as an adult now, I wonder if you are, if you, like, have carved out values for yourself that you thought you would have, and if you're comfortable with the values that you live with. It's one of these big unanswerable questions, but I think
you're right.
You know what I mean.
There is no answer. However, I never let that stop me. I think it really it really comes down to me. A lot of the traditional things, I think, the fundamental things apply. My family is so important to me, and here I am, hoist on by my own petard on this dichotomy that strikes us all in this business of, I mean, I'm having the pleasure of being here talking to you and to the listeners, singing for you, and my family's at home alone without me. And how do I balance this? And the answer is not all that well at times. Sometimes I'm gone too much. If I'm not gone enough, the accountant starts screaming. So I have to find a balance. And the balance is constantly changing, and it's difficult to do. I think that I'm down the road heading for more and more and more writing and more and more needing a real excuse to leave home. I mean, a real reason. Simply being asked to go someplace and sing is going to be a less and less effective method of getting me away from home. I do love it so. I love my family a lot, and I have a very rich life at home, a very full emotional, and I'm never bored. I've got a lot of things to do, a lot of good people to be with. And I've got this endless challenge of this blank notebook, you know, to make up new songs for. And I'm finding more and more ways of working on that while I'm at home. I mean, for example, I've been not on a steady basis, but fairly often recording new topical songs like the one I wrote about Nancy Reagan, putting it on good quality tape that is sent to me by WFMT in Chicago. And I send it out there, and they put it on their Saturday night show called Midnight Special. I don't know if you ever heard of that show. It's a wonderful 3 or 4 hour, mostly folk music show. And they even announce it as the Paxton Report. And I don't get any pay for that, although I hope, you know, later on down the line, I would love it if that could be, you know, get a sponsor or something and make a little money from doing that. Writing songs from the newspapers one a week. And for a laugh, or maybe sometime a little serious.
You were doing that on NPR for a while, weren't you?
Well, at NPR, it was more difficult because they have their format of stories they're covering, see, and if the songs didn't fit that format, they didn't get used. What I'm doing at FMT is I'm writing whatever interests me, and they drop it right into the middle of a mostly musical show, you see. So it works perfectly there. I wish that I could work something out with NPR, you know, because I listen to NPR wherever I am in the country, and I'm always getting in my hotel room and checking the lower part of the dial, finding the NPR outlet, and it means a lot to me as a listener, and I would like to work out something, and I'm confident something will work out. The other thing I'm doing is I'm writing songs for friends of mine, letting them go sing them. I'm sending songs to friends of mine who are already recording artists. I just had a song of mine was a top 40 hit in the country called Wasn't That a Party. It was recorded by, used to be the Irish Rovers, now they just call themselves the Rovers. But almost more interestingly to me, I wrote a song, I was jogging one day, and I got an idea for a song, a little children's song. And I wrote it and sent it to a friend of mine in Chicago named Art Theme. Art is, until recently, pretty much strictly a Chicago area folk singer. Sings in schools a lot. But I like the guy personally, you see. Now, as it happens, he's starting to get out and travel around a little bit more. But that's not the point. I like Art, and I got an idea for a song which I thought would fit him. And I wrote it, and I sent it to him, and he's the only person who has it. I did it the same thing recently for another friend of mine in Chicago named Fred Holstein, who records for Philo Records. And I wrote him a song, because I like him. It's like sending someone a card. Matter of fact, I think I would like to sing that song for you.
Sure.
Which kind of breaks my own rule about it. But
well, you wrote it. It's all right.
It belongs to Fred. I mean, it's up to him to let someone else hear it if he wants to, but I think you'll get the idea of the song right away. I never really knew you. I was a couple of years too young. By the time I came of age, the song of your life was sung. From the hills of Oklahoma to the North Atlantic seas, from the cries of the hungry children to the eyes of the deportees. They could take away your money, they could take away your land, drive you out to the endless highway, leave you out on the desert sand.
They could take the food from your hungry mouth. They could lock you in the hole. But they couldn't take the music from your soul. They couldn't take the music from your soul. Just another scruffy okie, just a Dust Bowl refugee, heading out to California, a little bit low on the do-re-mi. And everywhere you wandered, you saw poor folks treated wrong. And you made those poor folks your whole life, and you made your life a song. They could take away your money, and they could take away your land, drive you out to the endless highway and leave you out on the desert sand. They could take the food from your hungry mouth. They could lock you in the hole. But they couldn't take the music from your soul. They couldn't take the music from your soul. They could call you a dangerous radical, and they could call you a rabbit red, but it never really mattered, all the stupid things they said. All those lies and all those liars are all over the hill and gone, while your songs are still here singing and still rolling the Union on. They could take away your money, and they could take away your land, drive you out to the endless highway, leave you out on the desert sand. And they could take the food from your hungry mouth and lock you in the hole. But they couldn't take the music from your soul, Woody Guthrie. Or they couldn't take the music from your soul. And this land was made for you and me.
Thanks. Did have you read the book or seen the movie?
I've got about the book, Joe Klein's book, but yeah. I haven't read it yet.
It's always interesting to see how people are treated years later.
Well, you know, I grew up just 26 miles from Woody's birthplace of Okemo. I grew up in a town called Bristow. I used to play high school football against Okemo, as a matter of fact. And Woody still persona non grata around those parts. I mean, they just hardly recognize the name.
Really?
For
what reasons?
Well, because he had such pronounced left wing views. You see, they call him a radical communist, and they wanted to build some people wanted to build a library, a Woody Guthrie library in Okemo, and Chamber of Commerce tromped on that one, prevented it.
Did you ever request your Freedom of Information Act files?
Oh, no, I haven't. To be honest with you, I'm not all that interested in. I mean, part of me is convinced that if I did, it would turn out that there wasn't one. You know, there would be, you know, such a crushing blow to the ego that I don't think I could stand it.
But probably there'd be information in there. Would it be stuff you'd want to know, or are you happy you're not finding out?
Well, it just seems to be irrelevant to me, Jerry. You know, it's I don't care what those people thought. It would all be all wrong anyhow. I certainly have, you know, said things over the years that I would say differently now, you know. But I certainly got nothing to hide about my past, you know. No, I'm not very interested. I think that it was a lunatic time when it comes to, you know, all that surveillance and everything. They were you know, surveilling a bunch of middle class American kids who felt that things were wrong and wanted to change them. That's all. And not many of us were very dangerous at all. You know, we were just ordinary people, still are.
You were talking before about how much you enjoy your family life and the difficulties of being out on the road.
Yeah.
But was it ever hard to reconcile the urge to ramble about which you've written and many other people have written songs and the urge to be home and have family?
Well, it gets easier to reconcile that as you get a little older. I mean, you just start losing that urge to ramble so much, I'll tell you that. Rambling's very hard work. Even doing it the way I do it now, which is certainly luxurious compared to the way it used to be.
Rambling means motels now,
yeah,
usually, right?
Yeah, right. And, I mean, I'm grateful for these places, but I like my house, you know.
You're living in East Long Island?
Yeah. I live in East Hampton.
What made you decide to settle there?
Well, it's really a happenstance. We were living in New York, and our baby was, Jenny was just a few months old, and we wanted to have a summer out of the city, so we left Jenny with her grandparents one weekend and drove out to Long Island looking for a house to rent for that summer. We found a little shack that we could afford in East Hampton, and went out and spent a summer and enjoyed it, really liked it, went back again the next summer, liked it so much that we just stayed, gave up our apartment in New York.
Yeah. So what do you think about when you go to the Village now?
Well, I'm very mindful these days of the things I used to hear when I first came to the Village. You'd hear people who were, you know, that much older say, oh, well, the Village, you know, has really gone to pot now, boy. It just used to be great, but now it's awful. And, of course, when they first came to Village, they heard people saying the same thing. So naturally, as soon as I opened my mouth to say, well, the place is really going to hell in a handbar, I know that it's just, you know, that it's time to put me out to pasture or something. But it really is, you know, it's still the Village, still has its excitement and vibrance about it, and also has all the fraud you could hope for and scams and con men and, I don't know, I think the village is something you take what you can use and you leave the rest alone. It's still very useful, I think. I like going there. I like working there.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting for people who've like never had record collections or never listened to folk music. There's still a song of yours that they probably know anyways, which is the Kenneloration jingle that you wrote?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's been played now for quite a few years.
Oh,
so
but
maybe
I remember that so well.
Oh, yeah. It was on a lot then.
Yeah. Did you write that for
no,
the
No, it was first the children's song. And it was adapted. It was adapted for the Kennel Ration.
Can you sing it the way it originally
sure.
went?
Sure. It's not all that different. My dog's bigger than your dog. My dog's bigger than yours. My dog's bigger and he chases mailmen. My dog's bigger than yours. Our car's faster than your car. Our car's faster than yours. It has a lot of horn. It bumps other cars. Our car's faster than yours. I'm not afraid of the dark anymore. I can tie my shoes. I have been to the country. I am going to shoot. I am going to school. My dad's tougher than your dad. My dad's tougher than yours. My dad's tougher and he can yell louder. My dad's tougher than yours. Nyah, 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 nyah. My mom's older than your mom. My mom's older than yours. She takes smelly baths, she hides the gray hairs. My mom's older than yours. I'm not afraid of the dark anymore. I can tie my shoes. I have been to the country. I am going to school. Na, 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 na.
How did it come to be that the song that you wrote became used for the ad for Kennel Ration?
I don't know. Somebody at the relevant advertising agency must have heard it and said, let's try to use that or something. I really don't remember. Actually, it's ironic we should be talking about that because one of your largest department stores here in Philadelphia is probably going to be using The Marvelous Toy as a jingle this coming Christmas season.
Really?
Here in Philadelphia.
That must be useful. to have that happen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not the financial windfall that people think it is. The real huge money in commercials comes to the actors.
The ones who sing it?
Yeah, the ones who are in it all the time. You know, there's a lot of money that's made there, but for something like this, it's usually just a one-time only fee, you know. And that the kennel ration thing came at just a providential moment, because Midge and I had not been married long, and we had mostly been on the road. And we got our first little apartment in New York, and just at that time, the kennel ration thing happened. And after agency commissions and everything, we got $2,250 clear on that, which went further than it would now. And we got, we basically furnished our little apartment on that money. So, I mean, it was, boy, what a heaven-sent piece of cash that was.
Did anyone scream at you for selling out and having a song become a jingle?
Oh, I'm sure somebody did, yeah, but...
Who cares?
Oh, yeah. Hey, I still sing a few commercials whenever I get the opportunity to, because the money, as I say, is very good.
Which commercials have you done?
Well, last year I did a Miller Beer commercial.
Really?
Yeah, I was where the guys were tuna fishing. You know, you still catch tuna the old way. That was me singing the jingle. And it was a lot of fun, I got to admit to you. I mean, it was all done in one lengthy afternoon, but the creme de la creme of the New York studio musicians were there playing it, and it was just a ball to do it. And it really helps financially, I'll tell you that. It takes a lot of slack up.
Any others that you've done that I should know about?
No, that's the only one I've got in recent years that's actually out there on the tubes, although I did a test one recently for some dessert that they're still testing whether they want to do that or another version of it. So I don't know. It's not officially out and may never be. It's a funny business, I'll tell you that.
We have time for another tune if you'd do one for us.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to hear, or shall I just pick something?
Well, why don't you pick something, because...
Okay. I think I'll do something old.
Good. Okay.
I'm always force-feeding new songs to people, and then I'll do one that sometimes people ask to hear. Whose garden was this? It must have been lovely. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one. Whose river was this? You say it ran freely. Blue was its color. I've seen blue in some pictures, and you tell me you've been there. Ah, tell me again, I need to know. The forest had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true? Whose gray sky was this? Was it a blue one? Nights there were breezes. I've heard records of breezes. And you tell me you felt one. Whose forest was this? Why is it empty? You say there were bird songs and squirrels in the branches. Then why is it silent? Ah, tell me again, I need to know. The forest had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true?
whose garden was this? It must have been lovely. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one.
Tom Paxton, I really want to thank you for playing some of your music for us this afternoon. I've really enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed talking with you.
Nice to get back to Philadelphia.
And Tom's in Philadelphia for a performance this evening at the Bijou at 8:30 and 11, and Mimi Farina will be opening this evening. And thanks very much again.
Okay.
It's really been fun.
See you again.
If you're interested in his recent records, they're on the Mountain Railroad record label, and the newest one is called The Paxton Report. It's a couple of minutes to five, and all things considered, it's coming up at five. But I'd like to tell you what's happening on Monday afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by William Howard, who's the director of the National Council of Churches. And you may remember that, it was a while ago, I guess, by now. He was one of the people who traveled to Iran during the holidays to help the hostages celebrate the holidays. We'll be talking about a lot of issues when he joins us Monday afternoon at 2. At 3:30, Junie Stein will be here with her weekly review of museum and gallery shows. And 4 o'clock on the Alec Wilder series, the guest will be Thelma Carpenter. She'll be singing songs from musicals from the stage and screen, musical comedies. So that's 4 o'clock Monday on Fresh Air, and I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was Bill Van Wert, and the technical director today was Joyce Lieberman. The production assistant for Fresh Air is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening, and hope you have a very good weekend. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered.
Find ourselves working and having some things in common with people who have traditionally been considered enemies of the Catholic Church, enemies of Western democracies. I think that they're as reluctant to associate themselves with us as we are reluctant to associate ourselves with them.
They have been called communists, socialists, and stand in opposition to U.S. involvement in El Salvador, the Catholic Foreign Mission Society of America. They work with the poor, and to them that means working for change. Tonight in All Things Considered, a visit to Mary Knoll.
Mary Knoll priest Roy Bourgeois returned to New York today. He explained his temporary disappearance in El Salvador and criticized American involvement there.
Mexico has been critical of the U.S. role, too, and we'll explore why.
Also these stories, the end of a Japanese-American summit in Washington.
Predictions that interest rates will remain high despite President Reagan's success with his economic program.
Violence in the coal fields.
A Caribbean prime minister talks about the unsuccessful effort to overthrow her.
Plus a new brand of congressional interns.
That and more this evening on All Things Considered. Richard Harris has this news.
The White House and the Senate agreed today that Social Security benefits should be trimmed next year by $7.9 billion. But in a letter released today from Budget Director Stockman to Senate Democratic Leader Byrd, the administration disagreed with the Senate Budget Committee plan to save money by limiting cost of living increases. The Stockman letter didn't say just how the administration plans to cut Social Security. The Senate voted for the cut in Social Security today, despite pleas from Senator Edward Kennedy, who said the reduction would, in effect, turn the clock back on the vital needs of senior citizens. House Republicans and President Reagan are savoring their budget victory yesterday in the House. GOP leader Bob Michael brought the vote printout sheet to the White House today, noting that of the 60 Democrats the president personally lobbied, 56 voted with him. Mr.